Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special bonus edition of Underserved. In episode 75, we interviewed Jeff Taylor, founder of Monster.com and 14 other companies, including most recently RoverTrophy.com. Jeff was generous with his time and spent a couple hours with me in the studio. The second half of his interview is in this bonus podcast. If you missed the first half of the interview, be sure to check out episode 75 of Underserved, A Monster Idea. Let's continue with Jeff.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
I first got to Monster in July 15th, 1999, is when you guys were now in the mill. You know, the salespeople were there and you hadn't quite grown all the way out the carpet to the back wall where Brian Ferry was the CTO, but you could just feel the energy. Like the people are like on the phones, closing deals left and right. There was a palpable excitement and buzz there like every day.
You know, we moved from my little 135 Natick location where my server was in a closet into a bowling alley space above a Chinese food restaurant in downtown Framingham. I grew to about 90 or maybe 100 employees in that space. Then we started looking for a bigger space. A guy named Miller Newton that worked with us that had come from the parent company. He was very good at some of this operational stuff. Found this space in the mill. I went and looked at the mill. The mill was close to a million square feet, and there were only 600 square feet taken. The space we looked at was 75,000 square feet. We were coming from 10,000 square feet or even less. So we basically contracted for 35,000 square feet and said if we could grow into the space within a year and pay for it, could we actually expand into the space as we went? And I said, if I take all this space and need more, will you build me a walkway on the third or fourth floor, wherever we were, across the other building? And then I could take another contiguous space by building this walkway. They agreed to it. We ended up taking that space. We immediately needed the space. About the time you came in, I think, did we have the walkway yet?
Not yet, within a year.
And so we basically did what we said and more. And I think another principle for me in building a big company was having all of your employees in the same place was critical.
One other thing I remember is when you built out the Monster Den. That just became like the hub of the company.
Yep.
Like the breakfast stuff you had every day, the lunch stuff, having meetings there, getting a soda, you know, the ping pong and stuff like that. Just having a place that was like a nucleus of the whole company. That was cool.
So one of the things you might or might not remember about the Monster Den is it was full of air ducts. These kind of silver pipes that were on the ceiling, and it was a high ceiling place, really open floor plan. I got this idea to have everybody sign the pipes. So we had thousands of employees who would come either from our main location or all different locations, and everyone would sign the pipes. It's one of the things that I thought was just cool as shit. Like just to go look, I wish I still had one of those pipes because, you know, you had the original founding, you know, members, you know, kind of all signed, you know, kind of very close together. I think my DJ life merges a little bit here. That Monster Den would probably easily hold 1,400 people. And we used to do recruiting parties. At some point in my family life, I had gone from DJing full-time to DJing four nights a week to three nights a week to two nights a week. And I had three small children. And I remember talking to my wife and saying, like, I just can't do trying to run Monster and do all this stuff. And so I had stopped DJing. And my employees got my record crates and had a Monster party. I got there and they're like, oh, you know, who's DJing? It's like, you are. And it was the first time I DJed, I think, probably for about 3 years. And I DJed that party. And then we had a number of recruiting parties where only thing I said was bring your friends. And we would get 1,000 people at these parties. People would say, oh, do you want to meet the CEO? Like, yeah. And it's like, oh, he's DJing. Let's go up and talk to him. And it was so fun.
I can concur. I went to one of those. You meet a bunch of people that you wouldn't necessarily meet otherwise throughout the company because things were starting to get bigger and, you know, salespeople would be on the sales floor, developers on the developer floor and so on. But that was one time when everyone would come together. And that whole thing about meeting people, and you mentioned earlier how it's kind of had a domino effect on people's lives. I met my wife there. Tricia Horan was her maiden name, was one of the best telesales reps you guys had ever seen. Met her and, you know, we've been married ever since and have three daughters. And that wouldn't happen if it wasn't for Monster.
That's a really cool story. And it's one of the things that I noted. I think there's been about 30 Monster marriages. So if you think about that, you know, you've got 800 or 900 telesales reps. So everyone is 25 years old. So you just, you know, it's bound to happen. I remember at some of our sales events, I used to have to lay some rules down. Like, you can't be the person that falls out of the elevator, you know. The reality was that the relationships, you know, I pretty much said you can't be in direct report relationships, but I'm very encouraging of having relationships. And I think that that was something that people appreciated. But I just wanted people to be transparent about it and forthright, and, you know, worked well.
The sales conferences were legendary. Everyone wanted to get into that Westin in Boston to go out for the nightlife and all the fun stuff that happened at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's interesting. I met my second wife. We had Cool and the Gang play our sales conference, and we were all in 80s gear, and there were somewhere around 1,000 people at these sales conferences, and everybody was dancing and open bar. It's fun. And then after it was over, because I had DJed at the local clubs, I got some buses and we all went to Avalon at that point, which is one of the last big nightclubs that I worked at in Boston. And I called ahead and said, you're going to bring 300 people over. And the message hadn't gotten through. And so I had 300 people in line in 80s gear, all trying to get into this club. And the woman at the front is now my wife. So there's some funny stories that came out of that.
31 Monster marriages.
Yep.
One more question about Monster before we move on. How did you end up water skiing behind a blimp?
One of the things that I tried to do at Monster was to build our brand. We, I think, held that very well for a number of years. Through time, I had done a lot of different marketing. I was one of the first dot-com advertisers. I had decided in 2002 to be an Olympic sponsor. And I had this idea of putting a blimp in the sky that would be similar to like the Goodyear blimp. And so I rented one for a couple of years and we put it in the sky. It was amazing. And we went to NASCAR events. We went to golfing events and we just traveled around in the warmer areas of the country. And it actually was really credible branding for Monster. I was like, I think we should get another blimp and get a bigger one. So, you know, maybe one of them was 110 feet long and the next one we got was 150 feet long. So Richard Branson's team said, if you're going to put another blimp in the sky, you should challenge him to beat his water skiing world record behind a blimp. And I can remember saying, oh, sure. And then kind of moving on to the next thing. I had an assistant. Her name is Casey, wonderful woman. She passed away from Lou Gehrig's disease, and so miss her. So she called me and said, you're going to Florida, Panama City, and you're going to go beat Richard Branson's record. And I'm like, what? And she said, yeah, you promised. And I was like, by the way, what was his record? And she said, it was like 2 miles. So the next thing you know, I am in Panama City, Florida, and I am in a hotel room. I just got there about 11 o'clock at night. There's a wetsuit on my bed and it says, see you in the morning. So I put it on and it doesn't fit. And I'm like, not only am I not a good water skier. So I go downstairs the next morning and I meet everybody. And somebody pulls me aside and says, you have the wetsuit on backwards.
Yeah, zip it up the front.
Yeah. So I had zipped it up the front. And so I had this moment where I had to go off to the restroom and switch my wetsuit around. And it was like, okay, like this is crazy. So I said, how's this going to work? And they said, okay, there's three boats. There's going to be a boat in front of you that's going to cut the wake. The blimp is going to come from behind you with a 200-foot rope with a handle on the end and is going to bring that handle by you and you're going to grab it and then it's going to pull you up and you're going to water ski. And I'm like, okay, I need some gloves. I'm like, that was the first thing I said. So the next thing you know, I'm in the water. There's three boats. One boat has a scuba guy in it. And I'm like, okay, well, what's that guy for? And they said, basically, if you're down at the bottom, this guy's going to come down and save you. I'm like, okay, I like that guy. And then there's a group of press and my team. And then there's this boat that's cutting the wake. So the blimp, it's coming from behind me and it misses me by like 4 feet. And you realize you can't really just swim with the skis on. So I'm like, okay, this is terrible. And it takes a while for it to come back around. So I'm sitting there in the water and there's these fins coming at me. So I'm like, okay, like, what is this? And so they yell out, they're porpoises. And that's good luck. And I'm like literally peeing my pants. And so the next time the line comes, it comes right over me and I'm able to grab it. And I get up and I'm feeling pretty good about myself. And after about 25 seconds, I hit this barge wake that's coming across. It's just like a 5-foot roller thing that hits me and I yard sail. I come up sputtering and there's nobody in the boats. And I'm like, where did everybody go? Everyone is crying, laughing at me, the CEO in the water. I have just a little side story. I have 800 people in the Monster Den that are listening to this live. And my daughter is there in the Monster Den. And she says, is my daddy going to die? and so all the employees are like just cracking up laughing. So this is a very lonely moment as a CEO where you've gotten yourself into something that you know you can't get out of. And I've kind of just hurt myself. I'm not in very good sorts. And the blimp is coming back around again. So the third time it came around, I was able to catch it and I was able to ski 3.3 miles. I broke Richard Branson's record water skiing behind a blimp. And it was a interesting moment as I get picked up and I'm coming back onto the boat. I'm being interviewed. I'm exhausted. And also, it's just like this crazy, exhilarating moment. And I realize I haven't actually thought at all about what I would say. And so these are these moments as a CEO where, you know, I think it just naturally comes out of you. But I said that this thing about risk and reward and that you get to experience some amazing things. And it's all about our brand. And our brand is about, you know, there's a better job out there. There's things you can do and take these challenges and don't settle. And then the phone rings and it's Richard Branson. And they said, Richard Branson wants to talk to you. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. First of all, right? And so he gets on the phone and he basically said, like, I don't know whether to be mad at you or excited for you. So I'm mad at you. You broke my record, but I'm excited because I think this is going to be really cool for our brands together. And it was a really great thing. And so, you know, Richard Branson is more of, you know, he would have at the time been kind of like the Elon Musk of Europe. And so it got extremely good coverage in Europe right when I was building out all of my European countries. I ended up in 19 or 20 European countries. And so it's just a monster moment that's just part of the bigger story of the Monster brand, which was something that was really special and really kind of defined our company.
It's definitely part of the legend.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Underserved podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So Monster was a great foundation for you to jump off of and do other things. What happened after that?
So I had a opportunity to buy LinkedIn and was beginning to have those conversations. And my board was not supportive of it. That was a blow for me personally, because I've felt the innovation pangs of needing to continue to reinvent the Monster experience and not settle. So the board wanting to take profits was very much against my leadership style of where I thought we needed to go. I also wanted to start to have some variable pricing and talked about the idea of having some more auction-oriented pricing that might sit on top of our classic job posting rate, which was at that point close to $500 to post a job. But it was the same cost in North Dakota as it was in New York City. And that didn't make sense to me. And I said, why don't we create some tension where we get some variable cost built in with our flat fee cost? And the board said, no, again, it's just the profits of Monster and the way we were defined in the marketplace. They didn't want to take those risks. So I resigned. And it ended up that Andy invested in the new company that I created, which was called Eons. And when I started Monster, the average job seeker was about 36. When I was leaving Monster, the job seeker was approaching 50. I was 43. And I was like, I'm not going to join AARP. I don't understand that concept, but maybe I could do something that would be more dynamic and create a combination of things, a tributes business, which would be maybe that you could write your story before you pass away, as opposed to the obituary section. And I also wanted to do some social networking type stuff. Facebook had been invented and it was clear that we could start to do more networking, social type stuff. So I started Eons with the idea of having a portfolio of products that would be for baby boomers. And I knew that market well. The job seekers that I worked with, you know, millions and millions of them were coming into that age group. So I created a business. It was funded by top VC firms, General Catalyst, Sequoia. And long story short, I focused on the social network and Facebook that was going from college to high school. All of a sudden, their parents learned about it through that. And then in a matter of about a year, I got my kicked. I got up to about a million unique followers in our social network on a monthly basis, and it was really doing well. And then Facebook was like a tidal wave that just kind of rolled over us, and that was the end of that. A business, tributes.com, which was an alternative to the obituary section, ended up going on and being a successful company. But I would say that as a second time, a higher profile entrepreneur, that I created more of a bunt or a single at best. And so that was humbling, but also just part of the story, right? I sold that company, Eons. And while I was kind of on the bench, I got recruited by a company called Bridgewater Associates. And a guy named Ray Dalio, I did the research on it, and it's the biggest hedge fund in the world. And Ray was a big personality. And there seemed to be some culture differences. It seemed pretty rough and tumble. And I said, you know, maybe, you know, this would be an interesting thing for me to do. So I went down and interviewed in Connecticut. And I went to work for Ray. He didn't like me much, but his team, Greg and David and Eileen, the kind of leaders of the organization, said that, you know, Jeff could be a big contributor here. And so it's interesting. I just retired from working with Ray for the last 10 years in January. And I had a fantastic experience there. It was amazing to work for another culture in building the Monster culture. It was a culture where the employees would go through walls for you. Here was a culture that was radically transparent and, you know, radical truthfulness and was very direct and a lot of open feedback, both about strengths and weaknesses, and a lot of focus on not just your superpower, but also areas of weakness and how you need to get other people around you that have those strengths where you have weaknesses. And when you put that together, you get the power to go and actually be way better than you could be just by doing these things on your own. It was a really good culture for me. I was able to be Jeff in the middle of that culture, made a name for myself, you know, doing interesting things, and ultimately went from working for Bridgewater to working on Principles with Ray, helping him with his book and TED Talk and some of the animations, and ultimately bringing some of his tools out to the world. He developed a personality assessment called Principles U that's doing extremely well in the marketplace. It's an exciting kind of new assessment, and I really believe in assessments. I think they're an important part of understanding your teams, your employees. But that business didn't need to be as big as the tools business that was struggling a little bit to get traction in the marketplace. So I made that company smaller with the help from a few other people and kind of laid myself off in the process. that's kind of a capstone for me of a 10-year experience with Ray. I found him extremely challenging to me personally, pushing me, being a good teacher, being tough on me, maybe even tougher than a lot of other people. But I found if I could survive in that environment, that it made me better as a leader. And it gave me a new tool set that was a very complementary tool set to what I had developed as an entrepreneur through all of my other entrepreneurial endeavors. On the side, I have always loved restoring cars. And I was in Reykjavik in Iceland in 2016 or 17 and was on a glacier in this car. And it was a Land Rover Defender 110 with very wide tires and wide fender flares. And we were in 3 feet of snow, basically just crushing this glacier. And I'm like, this car is so cool. I came home from that trip and started buying Defenders. Bought one. I'm in the driveway waving to my wife through the window. She's like, oh, what are you doing? Then I bought another one and bought another one. And next thing you know, retired from Bridgewater and Principles working for Ray. And I've decided to start a Land Rover Defender restoration business, kind of reimagining a modern truck that from a VIN perspective and a born date is from the early 1990s. So that company is called Rover Trophy. You can find us at rovertrophy.com or at rovertrophy on Instagram. And it's been fantastic.
The vehicles are gorgeous. I mean, if you have the money to spare, I highly recommend indulging in
that. Yeah, I mean, I think the crazy part of this is like, I'm kind of like a CEO selling to CEOs and leaders of industry. And there are many different kinds of buyers. The interesting thing is I've had the experience of designing 4 or 5 different houses and different businesses. And along the way, I've picked up a lot of experience. And let's call it the wisdom of the design stuff that has always been at the center of my work, no matter what company I was a part of. And I'm just applying those same principles to this new business, building a brand, starting from a humble place, having a high bar of excellence, holding myself accountable to building a really quality truck. And the response in the marketplace has been unbelievable.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
I gotta ask you though, I've seen your Facebook posts about Burning Man, and it just seems like another worldly experience.
So one of my interests in music along the way was Burning Man. I was working in a club. My lighting guy had just come back from Burning Man. He said, I flew to Reno, took a bus out to the desert to this thing called Burning Man. I got off the bus. I took off all my clothes. I painted myself blue. And I walked into this festival for a week with a jar of blue touch-up paint. And I'm like, okay, that's friggin' weird. He said, but you would like it. And I'm like, okay, I don't know where this is going. And he said, you would build an awesome nightclub out there in this place. And I'm like, okay, so tell me more about this place. So there's basically no rules. There's federal, there's healthcare, there's services to try to keep you from dying in the desert. But Burning Man is a wonderful expression of self-reliance and creativity. And it's a festival of art and music and basically a society that forms for a week or two in the middle of the desert that doesn't have the same rules and the same constraints as modern society. And I fell in love with it. The first year I went out, I took a wedding tent and a big sound system, and I set it up in the middle of the night. And the next morning, people started saying, you didn't bring a wedding tent to Burning Man. And I did. And they said, that's terrible. So my first experience just like many of my experiences, was not very good, but all out effort and determination. I can remember I had these kind of bag chairs and I'd set these all up and this couple had come to me and said, like, we're so mad at you. I was like, why? And they said, you know, like, look, we're trying to have a little cuddle here. And these chairs are the most uncomfortable things ever. They said, come and just see how uncomfortable this is. So I'm with this couple and they're, you know, just being together. And it was very clear that I had not done a good job with my wedding tent or my chill space with my chairs. So that led to me building better and better theme camps, and naming it Root Society, which is the roots of our friendships, slowly through time, redesigning those bad soccer chairs and building these really cool clamshell type beds where I had, you know, 24 of these beds that would go into our chill spaces, and building a nightclub that would host maybe 10 to 15,000 people a night. It took me 3, 4, 5 years of doing it and trial and error and meeting people and growing to get to the point where I started to get dialed in. But then DJs like Skrillex and Bass Nectar and Wes, who's Diplo, and all of these DJs, Nora Impure came in 2019 when we were there last. All of these DJs found a home and would play for free and just played to the masses. And so now we go about every third year, maybe. So we're not going this year, the first year that Burning Man is back after a couple years hiatus. Likely go next year, I would think. We take 6 tractor trailer trucks and a couple of generators and backhoes and all of this craziness to basically have a camp that's close to 300 people and hosting maybe 10 to 15,000 people at night. And so it's our Burning Man experience. It's called Root Society. You can Google it and you can see what we've done. It's has been a fantastic sidecar activity for me. I know you're going to ask me. My other sidecar activity is I am restoring an old cemetery, which is in my town. There's 1,000 gravestones, and almost 900 of the gravestones were broken. And the town had the money to mow it, but did not have any funds to basically fix the graveyard. So I went and asked if I could fix it. And they said no. And I said, okay, you're just getting to know me. I'm just getting to know you. What would it take? And they said, you'd have to get trained and certified, which I did. And you'd have to fix 3 stones and bring pictures back and show me, which I did. And then they said, okay, now you can do it with a trainer. Now you have to do 10 by yourself. And I did 10 by myself. And then they made me basically the proprietor of the cemetery. And so I have full control over kind of fixing the cemetery. We have fixed almost 900 stones now over the last 7 years. And we go every Wednesday and Friday for 2.5 hours, 3 hours. And I now have a band of volunteers that any given week is 8 to 10 people that go with me. And we've basically transformed this cemetery from mostly 1700s and 1800s. The cemetery was closed in the early 1900s and has what I consider the colonialists of that era and that period and that area in Connecticut. They're kind of like the entrepreneurs of today. And so what I've done is restore the family graves of 115 Revolutionary War soldiers, the largest contingent of Revolutionary War soldiers that are named in the country that we're aware of. There's people buried from like 5 different wars in the cemetery. And it was so broken apart that some stones we dug that were 12 or 13 inches under the ground. So using probes, we were able to find the stones. And it's pretty amazing when you put a stone up that's been under the ground for 150 or 200 years. So we're probably a year or a year and a half from finishing. And then I'm going to use a Internet of Things grid and make it so that you can use your iPhone and you'll be able to go do walking tours in the cemetery. And it's a civic historical gift. It's wonderful for friendships. It's a great workout. And it's just one of the things that I do by kind of adding a little bit more time to my week. And that's one of my principles, is that you can add another day in that Tuesday night work late, or you can add another thing into your life if you decide to put your mind to it.
That's really neat. It seems almost like there's a theme about, how do I help other people manage their legacy? How do I make sure it lives on, kind of with eons and tributes and with restoring the gravestones? Is that a theme you think about often?
Yeah, I would say I am an optimist and I am action oriented. My definition of an entrepreneur is when everyone around you thinks you're crazy and you still think you have a good idea and you act on it. If you think about my entrepreneurial endeavors. I helped millions of people find jobs at Monster. How cool is that? If I go back to your question, I think there's a center around not so much legacy, but around passion and ideas and action and making sure that people are at the center of what we do and that they are cared for and that they care for others.
Jeff, I noticed a stack of note cards you have with you. You mentioned that you'd curated these over the years, capturing ideas and lessons learned. Can you share a few of those with our listeners?
As I've learned things, I've written down my principles, and I'll just share a few with you, and maybe there's a few stories in here, but one is, if you can't draw it, you can't build it. And I'm not talking about drawing a horse or a picture of a person. I'm not very good at that. But in terms of drawing an idea, I'm able to get an idea out on paper so that I can show it to you, Andrew, and you can say like, okay, I either like that idea or I don't like that idea. I have to envision what I would like to do, think about that. I have to visualize it and what that might look like. And then I have to actualize it by drawing it. And so a website is a very typical thing where, okay, what's your homepage going to look like? What's the function and where are you going to go? And what are you going to do at each of those pages? You can draw that. And if I'm thinking about a defender business like Rover Trophy, I'm thinking about, okay, well, what kind of car do I want to build? But then what's that collection going to look like? What's that drivetrain going to look like? And what's my visualization of what that truck is going to look like? And I need to be able to show that all as an idea. And so, you know, I think that website is just the newest example of me doing that. But if I'm going to put a blimp in the sky, or if I'm going to do a snow maze at the Winter Olympics, which I'd love to tell you more stories. Like, it was the warmest time in Park City that they'd had in 10 years. And I had a snow maze that had 10-foot walls, and they melted down to like 5-foot walls. So you encounter challenges. So we had plywood, and we were just shoving snow onto the top in these plywood boxes to build up the snow maze. And it was kind of a failure. My employees were like doing this at night to be ready for the next day, and everyone was exhausted. And so I was saying, you know what? This is the kind of thing you do as a marketer, is you try different things, right? And then Katie Couric called, and Katie said, we want to shoot the Today Show at your Monster Maze. It's like, bang, you know, like it goes from it's failing, we're not getting a lot of people through the snow maze, to all of a sudden it's on global television for almost 2 minutes. You couldn't even buy that coverage. And it was because of taking the risk with the snow maze, right? Back to, if you can't draw it, you can't build it. It's like imagining that, having the curiosity to go figure out labyrinths and snow mazes. So I built a crop circle outside of O'Hare Airport that you could see from the planes coming into O'Hare Airport. And my marketing team, when I said I want to build a crop circle, they said, okay, this is the first thing that I know we can't do because Martians build crop circles. And I was like, nope, there's definitely a person that builds crop circles. So then we went and found a guy named Stan that actually builds crop circles. We rented a 3-acre field where we planted a certain kind of wheat. And then in one weekend, they went and stomped out a monster and our logo in this wheat field. And it looked like a crop circle. And then we contracted with a couple of the airlines to say, if you look out over the left, you'll see there's a monster down in the field. And I drew that. I imagined that and said, I think we can do this. And then said, I'm not taking no for an answer, even when my marketing team is like, you finally came up with something I know that we can't do. So I have this thing. If you go to a meeting, you might as well run it. And my thing is that if you're running the meeting, then you're bringing your ideas to the table. It doesn't mean you're not drawing other people's ideas, but you're at least able to shape the idea that you're working on. So if you're sitting in a meeting and you're not running it, then you're actually going to be part of a support likely for someone else's idea. And that's a little bit of a generalization, but what I found in my life is anytime I could volunteer to be part of leading something, the experience I would have as the leader of it versus being a follower of it, so I could bring a piece of Jeff to that and I could experience it in a way that really through my eyes as opposed to, you know, through others. I think there's a couple of things that maybe I close out with. One is, if you're nervous, I think you're in danger of learning something. And most people try to avoid situations where they're nervous, which then means you're not putting yourself in a position where you get your adrenaline flowing, where you get challenged. And if you're nervous about it, the value of it is in if you can put yourself into that situation, then you're going to learn, right? Woody Allen, I'm not sure that you can quote Woody Allen with a straight face at this point, but he said something. He said 80% of success in life is showing up. And I think it's awesome. I think that given a choice of eating a pizza and staying home on a Friday night or going to a party, I think most people get a pizza and everything can happen at that party, you know?
I 100% agree with that quote. I try to tell my kids that and they look at me strange, like, really? 80% is just showing up? I'm like, yes. And the other 20% is not quitting.
There's a book called Oh, the Places You'll Go, Dr. Seuss, and it's a weird book, but it's basically a book about challenging yourself and sticking to your guns and pushing yourself. And there's a place in this book where it says, don't go to the waiting place, you know, waiting for your hair to grow and the bus to come and, you know, all this stuff. It says, go where the boom bands are playing. I always loved that. In fact, I tried to start a business product called Boom Band at one point. And I think that that's a pretty magical thing, is that go to that noisy place where there's a lot going on, where there's a lot of action to be part of it, as opposed to trying to stay off on the sidelines and keep yourself safe. And maybe I end where we started, which is that law of the jungle where you blend in to avoid being eaten or you stand out to attract a mate.
Excellent. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
You were a monster employee. Like, so first of all, just the comfort level, I think it's wonderful. And I appreciate the invitation. You have a great service that you provide here with Underserved. And I could tell stories all day. And it's just so fun to make the connection and to think about life as an entrepreneur and life in our world. And I hope that your listeners can enjoy what we share today.
I am absolutely sure they will, and we'll talk to them all soon again on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.